Yeah, I'm turning on the. I'm currently playing the role of the tech person and recording myself for this on my phone. The nice thing is, what I'm going to do is turn in a sermon from D.A. Carson instead of my sermon. Nobody will notice the difference. With this nerdy Canadian intellect, what? Of course, that's nothing like me. My wife said, "Well, you're kind of nerdy." That was the on-the-fly joke. One joke real quick for to save time, I'll just give you the outline. The outline is there was some debate about whether I could do Kings, actually whether I would be able to do Chronicles. Wendell and I had a little bit of a disagreement because we thought it fits, since it's a more positive retelling of the accounts of the Kings, that it matched our personality more. Like, because we're both infamous for the positive, optimistic outlook, we both thought it would be a good fit for us. It turns out that my brother-in-law took the high road, and we took Kings, and we allowed you to do that. So we're looking forward to that.
It'll be upbeat
and positive. Yeah, that's right. Right. There are three mischaracterizations. Well, there are three characterizations of people there. Some of them are not true. You'll just have to decide, make that decision for yourself. Okay. So the task today is really to highlight, I mean, there are 50,000 words in 1 and 2 Kings. There's 400 years of history. It's very dense. There's a ton going on. It's really difficult to sort of do an overview on it. And that's why Nathan and I decided that he would do more of the standard overview. And then my job today, hopefully, is to highlight some what is considered key turning points in the story as a framework for sort of understanding and keeping those in mind as you would read the text yourself. And, you know, fortunately, I didn't have a ton of slides, so it's not a big deal. But essentially, what we're going to do is talk about those five turning points where it really is, those are demonstrations of what the theme verse I was going to present today, which if you have your phones, you can turn to 1 Kings chapter 9, 1 through 9. And I'm just going to go ahead and read that. And I think this is the NIV version. When Solomon had finished building the temple of the Lord and the royal palace and had achieved all that he had desired to do, the Lord appeared to him a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. The Lord said to him, "I have heard the prayer and plea you have made before me. I have consecrated this temple which you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will always be there. As for you, if you walk before me faithfully with integrity of heart and uprightness, as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, 'You shall never fail to have a successor on the throne of Israel.' But if you and your descendants turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I have given them and will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. Israel will then become a byword and an object of ridicule among all peoples. This temple will become a heap of rubble. All who pass by will be appalled and will scoff and say, 'Why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple?' People will answer, 'Because they have forsaken the Lord their God, who brought their ancestors out of Egypt, and have embraced other gods, worshiping and serving them. That is why the Lord brought all this disaster.'" So as we begin, the first turning point that I want to talk about is Solomon and ultimately his wives and his idolatry. Nate put together a outline of the basic arc of Solomon that follows the what I would suggest is the thematic telling of his story, which is him assuming the throne, his application is in wisdom, is requesting wisdom and application of it, his building the temple and the palace, and then later years in the downfall. And I think on a superficial level, and maybe one that I looked at before I really decided to pay much more attention to it, is that arc. I kind of looked at that as like rock star, gifted, and then at the end, falling off into disobedience and sin. But if you actually take a closer look at the story, the author does indicate, and the math does prove out, that Solomon, from even before he took the throne, before he was succeeded David, was actually disobedient in his activity. And so instead of there being sort of like this high-end arc and then a drop, it's really a slow rise and a slow burn at the same time. For instance, Rehoboam, his son who succeeds him, was 41 when he took the throne. David ruled for 40 years. Rehoboam's mom was an Ammonite. So if you just roughly do the math, he's marrying women outside of his ethnic commands, right? He's already starting to do these things that are clearly forbidden in the law. And he, by the time he finishes the temple and the palace in the 24th year of his reign, right around that particular time, shortly after that, Jeroboam receives a prophecy that he's actually going to take over a big chunk of that kingdom based on the fact that the Lord has been displeased with Solomon. So instead of this idea like it happened way toward it at the end, we're really talking about two-thirds of the way in, the Lord actually pronouncing this judgment on him. So you see that by the time he gets the temple done and by the time he gets the palace done, there are already, if you just work that out, there are already temples being built. There's already an establishment of polytheism being done. He's starting to marry already. So at the same time that he's used by God to do these fantastic things, write a big chunk of the wisdom literature, create the temple for the Lord, and while the Lord is addressing him in this, he is in the midst of actually disobeying. And of course, that shouldn't be too much of a shock to anybody. I mean, it was a little altering to me when I came to that realization, but God can't wait around until we get our act together to tell us his desires for us morally, or else he would never do that, right? And I think it's easy to understand how one could compartmentalize their gifts. I mean, I worked for a company who the owner was a billionaire, and I spent some time with him, and he did some phenomenal things in business, but his first marriage and his first life was an absolute disaster. So it is conceivable that you can use wisdom like Solomon did to wisely govern, but at the same time, while you're doing that, be an absolute train wreck in other areas of your life. So I just think that that just a little background in that, that we might have a richer understanding if we understand that flow more chronologically than thematically. And so then what is the ultimate consequence of this, of his polytheistic, synchronistic activities that he does over the course of this while the kingdom is strong, is that when he dies, the kingdom splits, and the first thing that Jeroboam does is creates two centers of worship to discourage anyone from going to Jerusalem, and he puts them on the north end and the south end, Dan and Bethel, and he puts golden calves in them. And the first time I read that, I was thinking, well, that's quite a shocker from the heritage. But if you understand that this has been developing over the course of the last 40 years, it's already entrenched. So the consequence and the turning point is here, Solomon, with all the wisdom that he's given, is misusing it to the point where he's solidified the exile of both kingdoms eventually. Few generations later, the second turning point would be Elijah and Elisha's confrontation of the Omri dynasty. So when you read, and most of you know because you've had these, you've read these stories, and you have the a lot of you have the benefit of having them ingrained in you when you were Sunday school. But since I was raised Catholic, I never had any of these, and so not that they were new now, but there's always fresh things coming to mind when I reread these stories. The Omri dynasty is known even from extra-biblical ancient Near East documentation and evidence that it was considered really the pinnacle of economic power in Israel. And he's referenced as actually there's documentation that's been cited that references 100 years, roughly 100 years after his reign, that they still called it the land of Omri. Omri is no friend and no fear of the Lord. He is quite shrewd, sets up this trade arrangement with the Phoenician culture, solidifies that by having Ahab marry Jezebel. And part of that peace was that Jezebel then centers herself in Samaria, which Omri builds to become this sort of commerce focus. And the combination of Omri, the wealth and the success of that trade endeavor, and the mixing of Jezebel, who you know, who is quite serious believer in Baal, basically sets up state-supported religion of Baal in Samaria. And this is a dangerous combination because it's one thing to have a strong desire for paganism. It's another thing when you match it together with financial success. Kind of like perhaps in recent elections where we might look the other way about certain things because we are really interested in having success. But anyway, this is such a monumental force that the Lord intervenes in here with Elijah and Elisha. And what you get in this story is just a fantastic telling of God remaining true to his commitment that he made to Solomon early on, which means if you decide not to follow me, you've got, and you know the stories, you've got Ahab and Jezebel. And Jezebel actually is so ingrained and such a vicious monster that she is systematically destroying any remnants of Yahweh in the culture. So God decides to intervene in that piece for two reasons. One, he wants to show that he's serious about his commitment to Solomon and that apostasy will be judged. And the other reference there is that he's also protecting the remnant that still is in Israel. And what you get through the whole story, which is pretty fascinating, is this, the accounts of Elijah, as you know, the big sort of amphitheater accounts of him and his confrontation with Baal and those priests being destroyed after God shows with one guy, shows his power and strength. And at the same time, you have Elisha doing phenomenal big stuff, military activities, being consulted by even foreign dignitaries. Interspersed and peppered with those big ticket items are these guys caring for individual people, like helping widows who are poor, helping people who have infertility, drawing out a tool from some dude who borrowed it in a water. You know, you see these contrasting stories. And I think it's a rich telling of the character of God, that he is large enough and infinite to be able to handle any large-scale encounter from whatever human beings can muster. His power over nature, both on that grand scale, and his love and concern for each individual person. Of course, that's absolutely contrasted with the pagan gods who, if we recall when we did our Pentateuch thing, couldn't care less, really, about individual human beings. Human beings were there to serve them. This is illustrated, really, through the telling of Naboth in the vineyard. Jezebel, well, I mean, Ahab, what a pathetic beta jerk. Just who wants a vineyard and goes home and cries in his pillow. And Jezebel, who then, being the strength in the relationship, manipulates the system and takes care of it, although it's no big secret to anybody. People are just in the way, and it's just a matter of manipulating a few things and killing a few people to get what you need. She's already established that. So you have this monstrous activity with a real disinterest. And I think that's an interesting contrast between in the story. So as you read it, I would just encourage you to see the difference in how God reveals himself in those miracles and the breadth and the depth of them relative to the sort of competitive small g gods and the actual application of that worship of those pagan gods and what it results. But ultimately, the big turning point here is that they've stopped. Elijah has made this huge public event and show that God is stopping that, annihilating, showing his strength over that. And then ultimately, Elijah is used to anoint Jehu, who continues to not only get rid of every known ancestor of Omri, but then also cleans up and destroys and eliminates even more of the prophets of Baal that existed throughout the nation. So it's a huge chunk of Kings. They're absolutely phenomenal stories, and they tell a really cool picture of the contrast between this rebellion, paganism, and Yahweh's greatness, power, and love. The next turning point happens roughly 100 years later, and that's the character of Menahem and his his actions on behalf of Israel. To set the stage a little bit, Assyria is gaining a lot of strength. They're moving down north of Israel. They're besieging cities and assuming power and control over the territories. Menahem comes to be king by slaughtering a king before him. After that king, Shalom has only been in the position for a month, who he then killed the king before him, who had only had the position for 6 months. So a tad bit of instability and bloodthirstiness on the part of what's happening currently. But Menahem is really highlighted as sort of the poster boy for being a despicable, murdering, power-lusty dude. And he does that, since we've got sort of a mixed audience right now of ages, I won't go into the details of just how you've read it before. He does some stuff. So for instance, he gets... He becomes king. There's a lot of dispute about his legitimacy. This is exampled in one town that decides to close their doors to him and refuse to let him in. He takes the town and destroys everybody, including everybody. Just activity that even among pagan cultures was seen as a bit too rough and used sparingly. So you get a real picture that this king is completely has nothing to do with any sort of sentiment toward Yahweh whatsoever, and he's an insecure, power lusty guy who is a monster and vindictive. He faces this Assyrian threat of the takeover and decides to preemptively offer an arrangement of to become the vassal, and that essentially is an arrangement where a dominating culture would provide protection, not take you over completely for a certain amount of payment. And so Menahem essentially hands over Israel's sovereignty so that the Bible tells us so that he can stay in power. And he does that by exploiting the upper class people by passing that taxation, that money that he has to spend to them, passing that burden on to the people the breadwinners in the culture. The reason, of course, this is a turning point is because he's just handed over sovereignty, obviously a display of a lack of trust or an interest in Yahweh whatsoever, only in his short-term benefit. But the long-term consequences then is, this is just then the final step to ultimate exile by the Assyrians. Same kind of approach happens with Ahaz in Judah. Roughly 10 plus years after Menahem decides to do this, Ahaz, of course, is dealing with the same issue with Assyria. And he's also dealing with Israel, who teams up with Syria because they want to reject Assyria's reign too. So those two get together and say, let's conquer Judah so that we can use all of that force then to strengthen our resistance to any neighboring opposition. So Ahaz, who also is described in pretty bleak terms, child sacrifice, and I'm going a little out of order here too, but ripping down the temple to create a pagan temple, taking just an absolute horrible piece of work, also is willing, despite having Isaiah tell him that that the Lord would protect him against an Assyrian invasion, he discounts that in sort of a flippant way and says, I don't want to bother the Lord with that, when really he was really interested in handling things his own way and being pragmatic. He says to Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser, he says, I am your servant and your son, or your servant and your vassal. And he gives up the sovereignty in order to protect himself. And so then that is a major turning point, because essentially what you have then there is then Isaiah coming back to him and saying, the Lord was willing to do this thing for you and you have not done it. And so now Judah will be exiled. And it takes a little while, but ultimately that's the other major turning point. So both kingdoms basically handing over their sovereignty. And then the fifth turning point is Hezekiah and what I termed is his pride and foolishness. And Hezekiah is Ahaz's son. When he succeeds Ahaz, he completely cleans house and is noted as being super faithful and trusting the Lord. I mean, completely cleans house, gets rid of all the high places, gets rid of any, exhaustively getting rid of any traces, to the point where he actually destroys, I don't know if you recall, destroys Moses' serpent rod, actually historic pieces of Israel's history, because the people were worshiping it. So he's even willing to get rid of what would have been considered pretty significant artifacts for Israel in order to make sure that he's as pure as he possibly can be. And he's also pretty sharp administratively. He oversees some really cool engineering feats to prepare Jerusalem to ultimately be as capable of defending themselves as possible. And so the Bible, again, the author does a thematic approach here, but a chronological approach is that he becomes ill, and Isaiah says to him, right, you might as well get your things in order. Hezekiah prays to God, and before Isaiah actually gets out of the palace, he comes back and says, okay, the Lord's heard you, and he's going to extend your life. And then there's a big, huge scene in there where the Assyrians come down to take over Jerusalem. They play psychological warfare because they can't quite take it, the town, the city. There's a neat interplay in the story about them doing a psychological warfare on The people in the city that saying they really can't trust Hezekiah, and Hezekiah really can't trust his allies. It's sort of juxtaposing that trust and trying to break their spirit based on the fact that Hezekiah is known for trust. Hezekiah reaches out to the Lord again, and then miraculously the Lord kills about 20,000 Assyrian troops, and then they retreat for the time being. Somewhere in between all of that, the author does it at the end, the Babylonians, who are also gaining in power and strength and influence, send an envoy with the pretense of a get-well visit because of Hezekiah's illness. But really, they're trying to shore up what sorts of powers regionally they can leverage in order to pursue dominance for them. They get there. You know, the story, Hezekiah shows them everything, basically gives them a exhaustive military intelligence briefing about his whole operation, which is golden for them. Isaiah confronts Hezekiah and says, "What did you tell them?" And of course, he says, "Oh, I told him everything. I showed him every single conceivable thing." And Isaiah says, "Well, for that, this kingdom will fall, and you will be, the kingdom will be taken off into exile." And Hezekiah's response there, after Isaiah basically calls him out for his foolishness and pride, is, "The word of the Lord you have spoken is good," Hezekiah replied, for he thought, "Will there not be peace and security in my lifetime?" Like, such a short-centered, this guy who has all this faith, all these capabilities, it's almost like bookends of Solomon, and yet displays such foolishness and pride that he has no concern, ultimately, for his heritage and for the people. He's just pretty well okay that things are going to be all right now. Prideful, short-sighted, selfish. As a result, then, sometime later, we know that story of exile for for Judah. So essentially what I try to do here is some highlights that you can keep in mind while you're reading these, certainly turning points that demonstrate God's willingness. This is the point I was going to make. You know, Wendell talked six plus weeks ago about the idea of the contemporary sort of armchair superficial idea that the Lord is super, the Lord of the Yahweh of the Old Testament is this mean, vindictive, uncaring God, and that somehow he's different in the New Testament. And what you see when you read, even in Kings, is you see a creator who is, for lack of a better term, almost bending over backwards to bless and protect people and offer his love and his grace and his blessings, and a string of people who are his people deciding on an alternative. And so far from him being vengeful and vindictive, he's slow to anger and rich in love, right, that the Bible tells us. I mean, it's just absolutely phenomenal, the picture you get. So from Solomon's story of this direct rebellion to Elijah and Elijah, you being used by God to demonstrate both his seriousness of his commitment and his love for people. Both Menahem and Ahaz selling the soul of the kingdoms for their own personal peace and affluence and power. And Hezekiah demonstrating fantastic gifts and blessings from the Lord and blowing that because of pride and ignorance. I think it sends a real clear message of what God has done for us, what he did for them, what he was willing to do, how gracious and loving he is, and that perhaps we learn a lesson to be that remnant, not bend our knees to Baal, encourage each other to look at signs of syncretism and other signs in which our idolatry and other disobedience may filter in, and be diligent at each other for being pure to our Savior. So I think we have a song to close.
The other thing I wanted to say was, it's been interesting going through a series on the Old Testament, and we're going to close some kind of connection. This one kind of occurred to me later, but this.